Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 20th of May. Our guest this hour is the author of Grounded, A Down-to-Earth Journey Around the World, and a recent op-ed piece in the New York Times in which he talked about the Icelandic volcano thwarting flights into and out of Europe. He said that he wishes that this blessedly jet-free interlude could have continued a little bit longer. In the eccentric ground-level adventures of some stranded passengers, 700-mile taxi rides through Scandinavia, perhaps a horse-drawn stagecoach over the Alps if things got really desperate, he is reminded of the romance that we trade away each time we shuffle aboard an airplane. He and his girlfriend, Rebecca, set out to circumnavigate the globe without the aid of any aircraft. They took, instead of cruise ships, they took cargo ships. They took the Trans-Siberian Railway across the wilds of Russia from Moscow to Vladivostok and drove a car through the empty doomlands of the Australian outback. He's our guest this hour to talk about the amazing adventures that he and Rebecca had and how they circumnavigated the globe without taking an airplane. He's a contributing writer to Seth Stevenson for Slate. His work has also appeared in the New York Times, New York Magazine, Newsweek, Rolling Stone, and many other publications. He's received multiple Lowell Thomas Awards from the Society of American Travel Writers and has been excerpted three times in the Best American Travel Writing Series. He won the 2005 Online Journalism Award for Commentary and now lives in Washington, D.C. Hello, Seth. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's do the prelude to this. You've done an adventure before, but you and Rebecca are pretty well established, and all of a sudden you decide you're just going to circumnavigate the globe, and you get rid of everything. It's really quite a story.
Yeah, well, we felt that our lives had sort of sunk into these routines, and we were doing our jobs and hanging out with our same friends, and we wanted some adventure. We wanted a quest, and so we canceled the lease on our apartment, and we ditched all of our possessions, and we set off to circumnavigate the globe without taking any airplanes. And the airplane element of this was the fact that, A, Rebecca is terrified of flying, and B, that it's just... flying just really isn't much of a journey these days. It's just teleporting from point A to point B, and it's a miserable experience from the moment you enter that security line until you get off the plane at the end and sort of immediately forget about the flight. Whereas on a train or on a ship, you have a real experience. You're having a real voyage, and you look out the window and you you know, you're contemplative. It's just a much better experience overall than flying is.
Your friends and family thought that you were crazy. They thought that they envied you because you were doing this. What were their thoughts?
A little bit of both. You know, some people thought we were nuts to leave our jobs and set off and create this this unnecessary obstacle for ourselves of not taking to the air. But I would say overall, most people were a little bit envious. I'd say most people would love to have more adventure in their lives and would love to find some way to have a quest and a mission to go on. So I think most people wish they could come along with us.
I'm sure they did. Well, now they can, right?
Anyone who wants to set up and do this, I'd recommend it. It's possible to do. You too can circumnavigate the Earth. We were taking only public transportation, so it's not as though we were pulling strings or doing something special. Anyone who wanted to recreate this trip could.
Yeah, I didn't know that you could take a cargo ship across the Atlantic. Can you tell me why you went that route?
Yeah, it's a great way to travel. I recommend it to everyone. We did it because I'm not particularly a fan of cruise ships. I've taken a few, and I've never really enjoyed them. They aren't quite my style. But being on a container ship is an amazing way to cross an ocean. You're on a working ship, usually about 20 crew, depending on the size of the ship, and we were the only passengers on one of our container ships. There were two other passengers on another one. You get to hang out with the crew up on the navigational bridge, and they show you how they do a chart. They show you how they pilot the ship. You eat your meals in the officer's mess with them. You hang out and look for pods of whales and dolphins riding the bow waves. You're on a working ship, and you're wondering what's in those containers that you're hauling across the sea. It's great, and you don't have a bridge tournament. You don't have dancing girls. You don't have a casino. But for me, I really didn't miss any of those things.
How was your cabin?
It's nice. It's sort of akin to the kind of cabin you would have on a cruise ship, because you're staying in either officer's quarters or the owner's quarters. And so our berth had windows out three sides looking at the ocean and an ensuite bathroom, and it was very nice. You know, the meals aren't, it's not like there's this luxury buffet and gourmet restaurants on board. You're eating with the crew, but, you know, that's a small sacrifice. But the quarters themselves were quite nice.
Mm-hmm. And why were there only two of you? I know there was another couple for the journey over, but why not more people? They can only take just a handful?
Yeah, they only have room to take a few passengers. What happened basically is that containerization has become more and more automated, so they need fewer and fewer people on the ships to load and unload cargo. And that's opened up some of these cabins, and so a few enterprising shipping companies have decided to rent them out to people as sort of an eccentric vacation. And so that's what we did. But they don't have, these ships aren't set up to take aboard lots of passengers. They're really working cargo freighters, so they're just renting out sort of spare bunks.
Right. I remember you're talking about, and this must have been, describe it for us, quite an experience, to be stuck in fog on the way over for a fairly long period of time.
Yeah, so it's about 9 days across the Atlantic. We went from Philadelphia to Antwerp, Belgium, and there, dead in the middle of the ocean, we hit a foggy patch that lasted about 2 or 3 days, and it becomes incredibly claustrophobic on a ship with only about 25 people when you can't look more than 2 feet past the railing. And so, whereas before your backyard had been, you know, 20 or 30 miles of ocean as far as you could see to the horizon, suddenly you're enclosed in this little bubble of mist, and there's nowhere to go, and it feels very small all of a sudden on that ship with those people. But when the and at first it was kind of neat and eerie. After a while, it did become rather claustrophobic. And but when that fog cleared and the sun came out, and we sort of celebrated that moment.
I'm sure that you must have. What kind of safety rules did you get as you boarded this ship? Do they tell you what happens if there's an emergency, if there's a hijacking, if there's something wrong with the ship?
Sure, yeah, we got, on our first day, we got a safety lecture from one of the officers. He took us out, and he showed us how to put on our immersion suits, which are these big neoprene orange suits you put on in case you need to get into the ocean, which you don't want to do. They keep you from getting hypothermia, and they have little flashing beacons on them. And he showed us where the muster station is. The muster station is where you go in the event of any emergency, and he's, you know, it's sort of like there's one alarm if there's a fire, and you go to the muster station, or two alarms if the boat is sinking, and you need to go to the muster station. There's an alarm for piracy, but in the event of piracy, you don't go to the muster station, we were told, in case the pirates see you there. So in case of piracy, you hang out and just hope that the crew can overcome the pirates.
Right. And did they worry about that? Had they been attacked at all?
Our ship across, there's very little piracy across the Atlantic these days, but when we took a container ship from Australia to New Zealand, that ship had actually been pirated within the last few years as it was going through the Strait of Malacca near Singapore, and they told us it was very quick. Most of the crew didn't even realize it had happened. The pirates came on with grappling hooks. They went straight for the safe. They held the captain at knife point. They took out the valuables, and they were gone in 5 or 10 minutes. And like I say, most of the crew didn't even realize it had happened, but it certainly piracy still does happen in that part of the world.
The thing I love about ships is that you've got crews that are literally international. They're just from everywhere. I have a couple questions. One, what was the makeup of the crew on the boats that you were on? Because I know you were on several of them. And two, why do they attract people from all over the world?
Going across the Atlantic, the officers were, this was a German shipping line, so a lot of the captain was German, the first officer was German, one of the officers was Filipino, and then the engine crew was mostly Eastern European, Ukrainian, Russian, Polish. Then down below decks, all the people with titles like oiler, people who work on the engine, people who are scrubbing the decks, this was about 10 or 15 guys who were all Filipino. And that's the case on a lot of container ships. There seems to be a sort of attraction or maybe a tradition of a lot of Filipino seamen who work on these container ships. And so that when we took a separate container ship, this was a French shipping line this time going from Australia to New Zealand. That time our crew was mostly Romanian. So it all gets complicated because ships are under different flags and with different shipping companies and different crews. But we had mostly Romanian Iranian officers, but again, all Filipino deckhands, and in both cases, Filipino cooks, and their names were Cookie in both cases. And I gather that on pretty much every working ship you go on,
that's the name,
Cookie,
right? And then you had to, we're jumping ahead here a bit, but you had to take, well, tell us this story. It was the one time that one of you had to take an airplane, but you were trying to get from, was it Vietnam? Were you trying to get from Vietnam to Bali?
We were in Singapore, and we were trying to get
Singapore.
From Singapore to Australia to catch a, we had a connection with another ship in Australia, and we lined up a container ship, a cargo freighter going out of Singapore that was going to take us to Brisbane, and then we were going to be able to catch another container ship out of Sydney going to Auckland. But at the last moment, our container ship that was going to leave from Singapore had electrical problems, and they told us they couldn't take us. And we had to make this connection with another ship leaving from Australia, and we didn't know what we were going to do. And we ended up roaming the docks in Singapore, you know, trying to beg, borrow, or sneak our way onto any ship we could find. I was calling shipping companies. I was calling the sort of the harbor masters to ask them if any ships were leaving that might take aboard passengers. We snuck out onto luxury marina docks trying to talk our way onto yachts, and that wasn't working. And eventually, we spotted this cruise ship in the Singapore harbor, and we weren't quite sure where it was going, but I looked at the name on it, and I called up its parent company in London, and what ended up happening was I talked my way on board and ended up sprinting down the gangplank, literally sprinting down the gangplank with an officer from the ship, jumping onto the ship. They pulled up the gangplank as my feet left it. The ship's horn blew. The ship pulled out. However, unfortunately, Rebecca, my girlfriend, had gone back to get our backpacks at the hotel. It didn't quite make it back in time. And I decided that I made a calculation that she would be willing to take one for the team here as long as I could complete the quest around the world on the ground. She'd be willing to take a quick flight and meet me, which is what she did. So she flew from Singapore to Bali and met me 3 days later because the ship took 3 days to get there.
My goodness.
The flight takes about 2 hours. And we reunited. I reunited with her and with my luggage in Bali 3 days later, but I did spend 3 days on the cruise ship with nothing but flip-flops and a t-shirt, having to go to these dinners in the fancy restaurant there. The maitre d' sat me in the back corner.
Yeah, I'm sure. And you traveled, you and Rebecca traveled so lightly. This is, you need to give this advice to people who are going to do similar things, but it was not a huge backpack.
No, we took backpacks not much bigger than what a college kid would take to class to carry his books. Because you just find very quickly that you don't miss any of those things you don't have with you. You adapt incredibly quickly. And so I would recommend to everyone who wants to take a trip that involves, especially if you're going to be sort of, you know, hanging around in bus stations and train stations and boarding ships and doing a lot of active things like that, pack as little as you can possibly bear. And I guarantee it will be plenty. And in fact, after a few weeks or after a month or two of this, you'll want to get rid of things and travel lighter. So I won't speak for Rebecca, but I only had 3 pairs of underwear, which I would wash out along the way and rotate. And just a couple of shirts and not much more. And you adapt and you're able to travel like that. We had stored some of our possessions back home when we left our apartment. We stored some of the things we thought we couldn't bear to part with and we needed to keep for ourselves when we got back. And after a couple of months on the road, I realized I wouldn't care if that storage container just burnt up to a crisp and all those things disappeared because things just took on very little importance after a while. It was more the experiences became the thing that I was after. And I just didn't care about things. And so if I ever take another journey like this again, I think I'll bring an even smaller backpack.
Oh, that's interesting. So have you really streamlined your life as a result of this? You don't have much stuff anymore?
Try not to take on too many possessions. I think the lighter, just as when you're traveling around the world, even as you're traveling through life, I think the lighter you can keep it in terms of things, in terms of possessions, the better off you are. Now, I would say just the opposite in terms of relationships and experiences. But in terms of actual physical objects, don't let them clog your life up.
Right. You spent a lot of time on the water. What about the motions of the boat? Did you find, you must not, either one of you, be susceptible to any kind of motion sickness?
No, we were fine. You know, container ships are big ships, and so they have a slow, gentle roll. As long as the weather is good, they have a slow, gentle roll, which you become very used to. It sort of infected our dreams at night. Rebecca, my girlfriend, is an attorney, and she dreamt that she was back in her law firm, and you know, high up in the office tower, and that you know it was rolling back and forth, and files were coming off the shelves, and then she'd wake up and realize she was on the container ship. It's the thing that becomes tough is when you get off the container ship after 9 days at sea, get onto land, you need to find your land legs because the earth, you realize just how motionless the earth is. It's something you don't you sort of take for granted when you're walking around on the pavement, but it's solid, isn't it?
Yeah, it's solid. That's the only time I get seasick is when I've been out for a while and then I step on land. It takes a long time. You go to the bathroom and the bathroom's moving and
right.
Everything's moving.
How your brain has adapted.
Yeah, exactly. You also took, though, a ferry. Wasn't this in stormy weather, or was it you were recalling a time that it was in stormy weather? Where was that ferry? And
we took a ferry across the Baltic Sea,
yes,
from the coast of Germany to Helsinki in Finland, and it was an Estonian-run ferry. And the weather wasn't bad, but there had previously been an Estonian ferry making the crossing in the Baltic Sea that did hit bad weather and sunk, and it was in fact one of the worst peacetime incidents in European history. So we sort of had that in the back of our minds, but we got good weather. What we did not get was a wonderful experience on the ferry because we decided we were going to save money and not get a cabin on the ferry, and we were just going to sleep in what we were told were airplane-style sleeper seats. That, you know, and so we were expecting something like first-class seats in an airplane's first-class cabin that would recline, and we'd have plenty of room to stretch out and fall asleep because this is a 36-hour ferry. What it ended up happening was they were more like economy class, coach class airplane seats, really tight together and cramped in a windowless room deep down in the hold of the ferry, filled with people. Snoring, taking off their shoes, and just horrific odors everywhere. And we realized at a certain point that this was the worst room we had ever been in. So the following night on the ferry, when we came time to go to sleep, we just sort of sacked out in one of the empty lounges up top, one of the bars that had closed, and nobody bothered us up there, and it was a lot better.
We'll take phone calls for Seth. Seth Stevenson is our guest, contributing writer for Slate and author of Grounded, A Down-to-Earth Journey Around the World. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address, if you want to send one of those, is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls. Kenneth from Custer, our first caller. Hi, Kenneth.
Hello. I wondered what the price of travel is on a container ship, and how do you make arrangements to do that?
Sure. So there's you used to be, up until about the mid-1970s, you could just walk out on a pier and talk your way aboard a container ship. You just need to find the captain and either work for your passage or bribe him or whatever it took. Nowadays, the lawyers have come in, and it's a lot more regulated. There's too much liability involved. So you need to book your passage a couple of weeks in advance. And you can do that either directly through a few of the shipping companies. For instance, Hamburg Süd does that. CMA CGM, a giant French shipping company, does that. Or there are a few specialty travel agencies that'll do that. One of them is freighterworld.com, and there are others that you can find on the web that'll book you passage on these freighters. And in terms of cost, it's never cheap to travel long distances across water because there's just not a huge market for it. It's a bit eccentric, and they charge you for the treat of it. So the cost of taking a container ship is, I usually say it's about it's sort of in line with the getting a business class airplane ticket. And so if you think about that, going from New York to Europe or going across from the U.S. West Coast to Asia, think about buying a business class airline ticket. And that's roughly what you're going to be spending. But when you factor in those costs, remember, you're getting all your meals included in the officer's mess. You're getting all your accommodation every night, of course. And you're not paying just for the passage. You're not paying just to get from point A to point B. You're paying for an experience. It's a holiday in itself. And so think about that when you're thinking about the cost.
Right. While you were leaving the United States on that ship, were looking at airplanes that were going above you to get to Luxembourg or wherever in 7 hours or 6 hours. What did you think about those? Here you were on a journey that was going to last, what, 9 days, 10 days?
Yeah, we were in the port in Philadelphia about to board our container ship, and I looked up and I saw a Lufthansa jet screaming by overhead, and I was thinking to myself, gosh, in about 7 hours or 8 hours, that thing's going to be in Frankfurt, and it's going to take us 9 days to get across the ocean. And but I wouldn't want to switch places with the people on that plane because, you know they're up there. They're in that dry, recycled air. They're in those cramped seats. They've got insipid inflation movies going on, and all they're thinking is, I just want this plane to arrive, and I'm never going to think about this flight again the second I step off this plane, unless it's to complain about the turbulence or the little kid screaming behind me or kicking my seat. Whereas I was about to have a true voyage across the Atlantic, looking at starry skies, the starriest skies you're ever going to see because you're in the middle of an ocean with no electric light anywhere around. I was going to be watching pods of humpback whales go by and watch dolphins ride my bow wave, and so I was just fine with that trade-off.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps one of the more grueling parts of the trip was the bicycle trip you took, and this was in Vietnam, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah, so we did a cycling tour that left from Hanoi and went down to Saigon, we didn't cycle. It was about 1,000 miles or something, and we didn't cycle the entire way. We took an overnight train at one point. We had a support van that would take us a little bit of the way and then drop us off it's tough to cycle in the cities there. They're very crowded with motorbikes and trucks and so forth. So we would get a support van that would take us outside the city, and then we'd begin to cycle through some of the rural areas. Now, at first, so the cycling tour had recommended that you spend 2 or 3 weeks preparing, or even a month preparing, riding 30 miles a day, getting your fitness level up. Rebecca and I had been on trains and ferries and container ships and been getting no exercise at all for the previous month or so. So we thought, we figured, okay, we'll just be able to fake it until we make it. But it was pretty ugly the first day out there. Rebecca barely made it through the first, 10-mile leg before she had to give up and get on the support van. I made it 2 of the 3 legs before I had to give up. But, the lead peloton of riders would just zip out of sight immediately as soon as we started pedaling, and I would start choking on my own perspiration. But after a few days of this, I pretty quickly got into the swing of things. And by the end, I was tackling these hills in Vietnam and keeping up with the lead peloton and feeling pretty good about myself. That's the great thing about cycling. I mean, it's a terrific way to see a place because you see everything. You're at ground level. You're not moving all that fast. You can see everything around you. You can hear everything around you because the only noise you're making is the clicking of your chain. You can smell everything around you, which if you're in rural Vietnam can be kind of wonderful, the smell of the rice paddies and grass and just the tropical air. You can have a conversation with the person pedaling next to you. If you see something that's interesting to you, you can glide to a stop and put your bike down and take a closer look and then get back on your bike and pedal off. So it's a great way to travel, and the ancillary benefit is you get really fit too. So I've been telling everyone that this is the best way to see a country if you can find a way to arrange it.
You also remarked how beautiful that country was.
Oh, Vietnam is amazing. There's lush green hills and the lime deposits with the craggy structures that they make and little villages we go through. And, of course, the food was unbelievable everywhere we went. And people were very, very friendly. Little kids would run out at every time we would cycle through a little village. Kids would run out and give us high fives and yell hello to us. Very excited to see us. One of my fellow riders, a lot of the people on our tour were Aussies, said it's like the Tour de France as we went through these little villages and kids lining the streets to wave at us and give us high fives. So it's a terrific country to visit.
Peter in Winona. Hi, Peter.
Good morning. I thought I would share with you an analogous experience driving from Madison to Seattle without going on an interstate highway.
Mm.
Our friends thought we were nuts, and when we tell the story, they still think we're nuts. But my wife and I did it a couple of years ago. Back roads, dirt roads across Idaho, remote campgrounds that nobody else was in that were absolutely beautiful. I took a bicycle, and I would... we'd stop someplace along the way. I'd get my bicycle gear, and my wife would drive ahead 20 or 30 miles, and then I would bicycle and catch up with her, and she would sit in the car and read a book or go for a walk. I couldn't agree with your guest's approach to travel more. It's a wonderful way to go. There's so much to see. If you fall out of an airplane and land on an interstate, you could be anywhere in the country. But to get on the back roads, you see what's out there. So it's not going around the world, but it was a similar adventure, and it was great fun. I highly recommend it.
Oh, it sounds lovely. And you did something similar a few years ago when you went to Alaska.
We did. We drove. We 7 years ago, we sort of did the same thing we did this time, where we quit our jobs. we seem to have a bit of a pattern here. We quit our jobs, and we drove up to Alaska. We're spending several months doing it when we were pretty young. But the caller sounds like a really terrific trip.
Yes.
That you took. And, you know, anytime you can sort of get off the beaten path and travel in a way that other people aren't doing, I think there are rewards there. And I would also say that interstate highways, they're sort of the airplanes of the ground, aren't they? I mean, you don't really see anything. You move. The point is to move really fast from point A to point B without really seeing anything. So in that sense, well, I'd say that they are sort of like airplanes.
Well, exactly. That's exactly right. If you see every intersection looks like every other intersection. And the icing for us was we needed to pick up somebody at the airport at 1:30, and we arrived there exactly 1 minute earlier, never having been on an interstate. So it was a wonderful trip. I recommend it.
Hmm. Thanks, Peter. Our number, we have a couple lines open now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Jeff in Superior, hi.
Hi, I'm inspired by your sense of adventure here. It's a great story. And I'm curious if you can tell me if you had any memorable experiences of seeing wildlife, like migrating birds or orcas or something like that.
Well, we did from our container ship going from Australia to New Zealand. We saw a pod of humpback whales, and that was amazing to see. We spotted these plumes of water shooting up out of the ocean, you know, one after another, and for a second we couldn't figure out what it was. Then we realized it was a pod of whales. It's sort of like this eerie pipe organ where you see these blowholes sort of explode in random patterns as the pod of 20 or 30 whales goes by. So we saw those. We saw a pod of dolphins riding the bow wave of the container ship, which is a lot of fun. They're sort of playing around and jostling each other for the lead position up there at the front of the container ship, sort of jumping out of the water and accelerating and then dropping back. We saw when we drove, we did a road trip across the Australian outback, which is possibly the best road trip on earth, and saw tons of animals there, a lot of them dead because they've been hit by cars, a lot of dead roos in the ditches alongside the road, but also a lot of live roos a lot of insects. I'm trying to think if we saw any interesting birds on our trip. I'm sure we did, but they're not coming to mind right this moment.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks very much for the call. Let's talk about your time in Moscow. It sounded a bit dreary.
Yeah, well, our whole time in Russia, maybe Rebecca, my girlfriend, I think liked it better than I did. Maybe I was just in the wrong mood for it. I don't know, but I found Russia to be a fascinating place. I would recommend to anyone who wants to travel there. It's a very interesting place to go. We took the Trans-Siberian Railway all the way across the country, and there was a lot of beautiful scenery. And we met some lovely people. We shared train cabins with Russians who were delightful, and they would instantly break out the vodka and the brown bread and the sausage and make a little picnic with us, and we would chat with them. And even though we didn't have a ton of language in common, we would find some way to communicate. But I did find the sort of the surface level interactions with Russian people in most places I went were a little bit gruffer than I'm used to in most places in the world that I go. There was a sort of not a ton of willingness to meet us halfway when we didn't speak Russian that you might find in other places. I don't expect people in foreign countries to speak English, of course. That would be, incredibly rude of me to expect them to speak my language. What I do think would be nice is if they were willing to try to communicate with me when I'm, say, trying to buy a train ticket and I don't speak the language and I'm doing my best and using a few Russian phrases and hand gestures. I would found that sometimes, though, the Russian clerk at the train station would just sort of look at me with a blank face and shrug. And there's a certain kind of aggressive shrug in Russia. It's not like the shrug that we're used to here. It's a shrug that doesn't say, I don't care. It does say, I don't care, but not only that, it says, I don't like you. So mm-hmm. we ran into a lot of that.
Hmm. And talk about the experience of, it was a museum you wanted to go to, and yet something was wrong with the ticket machine?
Yes, it was. This was the 20th Century Art Museum in Moscow, and we were excited to see the social realist art there. And so we got in the line, and we realized after a few minutes that the line wasn't moving at all. And then sort of word passed back. Now, this line was filled with people from all over the world, Koreans, Poles, Germans, Americans, and the line wasn't moving at all. And word somehow filtered back that the ticket machine had broken up at the front desk, and so they weren't able to print tickets. Now, you would imagine that they would say, okay, our ticket machine is broken. We'll just hand write up, little signs, tickets for people so we can get people on their way so they can see the museum. But no, that wasn't going to happen. What was going to happen is we were just going to stand in the line indefinitely. And I got the sense that was not a rare event, not a rare sort of approach in Moscow. It was also the line that we found there was a sort of... it was a study in comparative patience among different people in the line, and I hesitate to attribute it to nationality. I don't want to make, stereotype too much, but I did find that people from different countries had slightly different levels of willingness to stand in that line with no end in sight.
And you affiliated yourself with the Polish people, I think, and their response.
Yes, just sort of a resigned willingness to stand there, whereas my girlfriend Rebecca, not the most patient person. She seemed to find a kinship with the Korean people in line who were yelling, waving money, and trying to form a private tour group, which they said would then exempt them from needing to get tickets. And she wanted to join their private tour group. She thought that they had the right idea.
Let's go to David in Lake Geneva. Hi, David.
Good morning. Thank you for the program. It's very interesting.
Glad you
like it. I had a question about crossing the Pacific Ocean. You spoke a little bit about crossing the Atlantic, and I was wondering if you crossed the Pacific in one grand crossing or if you were able to island hop. And if so, how did you do that?
Great. So we, from Australia, as I said, we did a road trip across the Australian outback that eventually took us to Sydney, and we got on a container ship from Sydney to Auckland in New Zealand, and that's about 3 days. And then once we got to New Zealand, it actually was a rather tight connection where our container ship arrived in the port, and what we had leaving out of New Zealand was a cruise ship, because we decided we were going to experiment with cruise ships. We'd done every other kind of way to go across an ocean, to go across water. We'd done ferries. We'd done a high-speed catamaran. We'd done a container ship. And so we thought, okay, let's take a cruise ship. And this was sort of our final leg. So we splurged a little bit on a high-end cruise ship that went from Auckland to Los Angeles. It took 19 days, and it did island hop. It went to French Polynesia. It didn't go to Hawaii, and it turns out there's not a lot of landmass between New Zealand and Los Angeles, so there wasn't too much island hopping you can do if you're taking a relatively direct route. But the cruise ship itself, I loved French Polynesia. I thought it was an amazing place. We loved Bora Bora and Moorea, these islands there that are just little gems, and we went snorkeling there and scuba diving, lovely places. The cruise ship itself was incredibly luxurious, and they would bring these shrimp platters every evening at 5 p.m. to our room, and all alcohol and food was complimentary, and so we would just order these fancy umbrella cocktails every night and eat, filet mignon and gourmet Southeast Asian food in the restaurants. But the luxury became actually sort of overwhelming, after a week or two into this, where I began to resent the gluttony of myself and everyone around me. And by the time the ship hit port in Los Angeles, I just sprinted off it. I couldn't wait to get off and get into the real world again.
Thank you.
Thanks, David, for your call. Marianne is next. Hi, Marianne.
Good morning. I am really excited to be listening to the person who's done some freighter cruising. I've looked at it and shopped it myself, but have two very basic questions.
Mm-hmm.
Does it smell from diesel, and is it loud from diesel engines? I can't think of anything more uncomfortable than being in the middle of a beautiful ocean and having your sense of smell and sound being overwhelmed. Can you help?
No, have no fear. You got to do this. You got to get out there on these ships. Certainly, if you go down to lower decks where the crew is working, you're going to get some diesel smells. You're going to get all sorts of smells down there. It's going to be loud. But your cabin is going to be high up in the superstructure at the back of the ship, which is where the navigational bridge is. And when you get way up there, you don't get the diesel smell anymore, and the engine noise is much reduced. And that was no problem at all, for instance, for sleeping, and we didn't have any smell. And the other thing, during the day, when you're not in your cabin, you can go up to the forecastle, which is the very front of the ship. It's this little, the bow area in front of the containers. And up there, you know, the engine's at the back of the ship. And when you're up there at the front, you know, these ships are huge, so you're a couple of football fields away. You can't hear the engine at all. You can't smell the diesel at all. All you hear is the smacking of the waves against the hull, we would just hang out there for hours on end looking for birds and I just remember that we did see some birds. We saw gannets when we were in the English Channel, and we saw albatrosses. So we did see actually huge ocean birds as we were making that passage. But if you hang out up there on the forecastle, it's as quiet as you could possibly imagine. And so I think you go out there and do it. Just don't go down below decks, because that's where you hear that grinding engine, unless you want to take the engine tour, which we did, which was a lot of fun.
So you're thinking of doing this, Marianne?
Excuse me?
You are thinking of doing this?
Oh, yeah. I've been shopping it online. I've been on Freighter World. I've been reading what I can find, and it's exciting to actually talk to someone who's had the experience, because the questions I had were really the ones that were kind of stopping me from going, because I wasn't sure just how those two things were going to play out.
Right.
No, don't let that stop you. I think you'll be fine with it. I don't recall that being a problem for me at all. And I'm sensitive. I know exactly what you're talking about, that sort of diesel-y rumbling ship experience, and that was not a problem for us at all.
Mm. Thanks, Marianne, so much for the call. I was amazed, and I guess Rebecca shares the credit for this, or should be given the credit for all of the planning it takes to do a trip like this. You've got bikes and trains and cruise ships and container ships and ferries. It's a lot of different kinds of travel.
Yeah, well, Rebecca, my girlfriend, is a bit of a logistical genius, and so she was on top of all of this. And we really didn't plan very far ahead when we did this. We knew we were going to take a container ship across the Atlantic, and we had a vague sense that we wanted to take the Trans-Siberian Railway all the way across Russia. But beyond that, we didn't know specifics, and we didn't know what we were going to do after we got on the train in Russia. We had no idea where we were going to go or how we were going to get there. But along the way, we would stop into internet cafes in Russian towns and get on the web and look around and figure stuff out, figure out the next leg. And the internet is just changed travel. It's amazing how you can plan a trip now on the fly in a way that would have been very hard to do before the internet. You know, it used to be you'd have to go find the expat bar, wherever you were, and talk to people and get sort of vague intelligence about how you can get from here to there, and, oh, no,
right,
that border's closed, and so forth. Now, you go on the web, you go to some traveler's chat board, and somebody's crossed that border yesterday and instantly gone online to tell you all about it, and here's the right border to cross, here's the guard to talk to, here's the guard not to talk to.
Oh, goodness, isn't that something?
It just makes it a lot easier to do it now.
Yeah. More phone calls. We welcome our guest is Seth Stevenson, his book Grounded, a down-to-earth journey around the world, in which his girlfriend Rebecca traveled around the world, and for Seth, never once being in an airplane. And so it's a travel by all the other modes of transportation, and sometimes pretty unusual ones. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655 is our number. Seth, do you figure that you and Rebecca will always have wanderlust, or is it put on hold for a while because you've had your fill of extraordinary travel?
Oh, I think it'll always be there. You know, people have asked me what was where did we have the most culture shock on this trip? And the answer is the moment of the most jarring culture shock was when we came to a stop at the end of the trip. We got back to Washington, D.C., and we'd done the whole circumnavigation, and we stopped moving. And that was a brutal readjustment because motion can become its own drug in a way, and you can become addicted to that feeling of what's the next place, what's the next city, who are we going to meet next, what kind of food are we going to eat next, what kind of transportation are we going to board next. And when that ended and we got back to Washington, D.C. and sort of re-entered our regular lives, it was very tough for me at first. Everything seemed so pointless and boring. All I kept thinking is, I circumnavigated the earth. I don't need to go get the mail. That was tough. We're always sort of looking for that next chance to break away. But of course, life has practical concerns too. And sometimes you need to earn some money or need a little bit of stability for yourself.
And what about your jobs? Were you able to walk back into them when you returned?
Well, I'm a freelance journalist, so I have a very flexible job that does allow me to do things like this. It's pretty simple. I just stop writing stories and, of course, stop getting paid. my girlfriend, Rebecca, she's an attorney, and she quit her job at a law firm she'd been at. She'd been there for a few years, and she'd had a good experience there, but she was sort of ready to move on to the next career adventure anyway. And so she quit her job and to do this trip. And when we got back, she got a job at another law firm.
Tom in Burlington, hi.
Yeah, I want to ask a question for Kathleen. Did you have any good chocolate over there in when you went around the world? And the next question is, how was the cell phone communications? Were you able to do that?
Did we have any good chocolate? I would say that Europe is probably would be the among the places we went would be the chocolate capital. But we actually moved through Europe pretty quickly because it was expensive. The exchange rate at that time was brutal, and we wanted to get out of there as quick as possible so we didn't completely deplete our funds. I've lost. What was the second question?
Cell phones.
Oh, cell phones. Oh, right. So we had an unlocked mobile phone that we took with us. And so when we got to any country, we could buy SIM cards and pop them in and have a local number. But we didn't end up using it that much. I mean, we used it once in a while. We would buy a SIM card and call our families to tell them we were still alive. And we used them sometimes to meet up with when we had friends in a city abroad. We would buy SIM cards so we could meet up with them and be able to to connect with them and locate them when we were going out to dinner or something like that. But we didn't end up using it too much, and I think we would have been just fine without it, actually.
Mm-hmm. And there was a time when you got to remember to charge those cell phones. That was important at some times when you forgot to do that.
Yeah, so that became the one time that the cell phone actually was a vital tool was this time when I ran onto this cruise ship in Singapore and Rebecca didn't make it aboard. And we hadn't planned for this contingency, and so I was desperately calling her, trying to tell her, fly to Bali, meet me in Bali, 3 days from now, because I sprinted aboard with an officer from the cruise ship, and I asked him as we were running, what's the next stop? And he said, Bali in 3 days. And so I was calling her, trying to tell her that, but I hadn't charged my cell phone. It was running out of batteries and ran out of juice as I was in the middle of trying to tell her this. So I had to borrow this cruise ship officer cell phone and car, and eventually I was able to. At the same time, the ferry was pulling away from the harbor, and so we were losing cell phone service. It was about to go out entirely any minute, and so it was a bit desperate there for a moment, but I was able to convey to her where to go and when to get there, and it all worked out.
Thanks, Tom. Jody, Brownsville, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
I want to tell you a little story. 1980, I was three and a half years into a four-year hitch in the Marine Corps, and a corporal before me had done a European trip, told me about it, so I decided, well, I'm going to go for it. And took a military hop across the pond, flew into Frankfurt, and basically from there just winged it with a 30-day Ural pass and a list of hostels and a backpack and a sleeping bag, and ended up in Athens, Greece, about 26 days later, traveling the whole length of Europe all the way down, so... But really interesting, a thing that I'll never forget.
No, I'm sure you won't.
And just took the advantage. And the thing is, if you look for it, the advantages are out there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, if you really want to make something like this, that's what I tell a lot of people, to say, oh, I could never do something like that. I think, you know, everyone's circumstances are different, of course, but I think if you really make it your mission to do something like this, you can find a way to make it work. And the thing about, you know, talking about traveling around Europe on the Eurail Pass, that is a great way to see Europe. And nowadays, they have these really cheap flights, Ryanair and these super low-budget airlines in Europe. So people take these, you know, $20 flights between European cities, but I think they're missing out on a lot. I think on the rails, you have better experiences. You see the countryside. You have sort of more relaxed conversations with the people you may meet in the dining car, on the train, or in your cabin. And I think it's a shame that people are taking these budget short-hop flights around Europe these days. I think they're really missing out.
Mm. Well, many of them are taking trains these days, too, right, because of volcanoes.
Sure, that volcano, I understand that it costs a lot of people a lot of money, and it slowed down the economy, and it caused a lot of hassle and hardship for people, and that's a shame for those people. At the same time, maybe it was a bit of a blessing in disguise. I mean, I don't think anyone was injured in the course of that whole deal.
Right.
And I think a lot of people were forced into surface journeys they wouldn't otherwise have taken, sort of these romantic journeys where they had to, you know, to hire a stagecoach to get, you know, we had heads of state in Europe taking 1,000-mile cab rides, I think, stuff like that. And I think a lot of people may remember those journeys and think to themselves, gosh, that wasn't so bad. That was kind of fun. It was a lot more interesting than an airplane. Maybe I should do that again.
Jody, thanks. In Oconomowoc, Tom. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Seth, I'm in awe of anyone who has the opportunity to take these kinds of adventures, and I have two quick questions. One, what was the total time frame from start to finish of your trip? And if you wouldn't mind sharing, I'm kind of interested in what the total cost was for you guys on this trip.
Sure. In terms of total time frame, we did it in about 6 months. I think if you wanted to go as fast as you could using public transportation, you could circumnavigate the Earth in about 45 days. I don't think you could do it too much faster than that. And of course, you'll remember that Phileas Fogg did it in 81 days. He made his bet in the 80 days, but it was actually 81
because
of the international dateline. You could do it, of course, a lot slower than that, too. But after a while, you know, you have to start to decide, well, am I taking a break from my regular life, or am I becoming a permanent nomad? And we were in danger of slipping into that second category if we let this take, you know, a decade to complete the circumnavigation. In terms of cost, I haven't sat down and totted up the entire cost of it. Like I say, the container ships, going across water gets expensive, and container ship is about equivalent to a business class airplane ticket. But when you're on land, you can do it as cheap as you want. I mean, you can travel on a shoestring, and there are all sorts of guidebooks that will help you figure out how to do that. And we were not traveling expensively on land. We were staying in budget hotels. We were taking trains that working class people in the countries we were in take all the time. And so, you know, on land, you can do it as luxuriously or as cheaply as you like. It's going across water that you don't have much of an option, and you're going to have to fork out some money.
Sure. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks, Tom.
Enjoy the program.
And John from Nina. Hi.
Good morning. Quickly, I'm wondering how your relationship went over the course of the trip, if it was enhanced by the excitement or maybe you had some rough times. And then secondly, how the heck do you adjust to life after this? You touched on it a little bit, but what do you do now? The Seven Summits, Antarctica, what?
Sure. In terms of our relationship, we've always sort of been a bit mischievous and done trips like this, and Rebecca and I are partners in crime, always looking for the next quest to go on. And so we had a great time, and we came out, you know, I think stronger than before from this trip. I would say to anyone else who's going to do this with another person, make sure it's, you know, I wouldn't make this maybe the first leg of the journey,
right,
of your relationship.
Right.
You know, this might be something you want to do once you know each other pretty well, because you're going to be spending a lot of time in very cramped quarters on trains and in ships and elbow to elbow wherever you go. And so it's someone you want to be able to spend a lot of time with in very close proximity. You know, of course, we had a couple of fights along the way. That's going to happen. But we overcame that pretty quickly, And, you know, it's, I think it's great for a relationship to share an adventure and to share, to overcome obstacles together like that. I think it can be wonderful, and really bring you together. In terms of the readjustment, like I said, it was actually really tough because you get used to feeling like this juggernaut conquering the earth, you know, actually physically conquering the earth, going, you know, crossing lines of longitude, crossing the equator, covering thousands and thousands of miles. And then eventually you come to a stop and you're just going to your job every day and paying the bills and eating in the same rotation of takeout food. And that's tough. The adventure is sort of over and you have to start to find ways to find adventure in your regular life. And it is a little bit tough, but, we always have our eye out for the next quest. Right now we're thinking, maybe it will have something to do with sailing. Maybe we can find some way to take a sailboat across a body of water. But, we're just getting started on that. So check back with us in a couple of years.
So the water part of this journey was your favorite? Being on the water?
I do. I love being on the water. There's nothing like being on a ship in the middle of an ocean. And it's something that I think not a lot of people get to experience very much these days. I mean, maybe we'll take a ferry a little ways between a couple of places, but we're always in sight of land. Maybe we'll take a sailboat around a harbor or something. But not a lot of people these days are taking ocean liners or container ships to cross huge bodies of water. It's sort of a lost pleasure, and I think if people could rediscover it, they might find it's something. It's a little, you know. It's of course, you know, I wouldn't want to deny people the ability to fly
We're
an airplane
out,
from the U.S. to Europe.
Time.
It's very convenient, but I think we've lost something with those transatlantic
right.
passages we used to do.
Yeah, thanks, Seth. Seth Stevenson, and the book is Grounded: A Down to Earth Journey Around the World, available in paperback. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this program, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production. And thank you, everybody, for all of your calls. Great conversations ahead.